From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democrats are demanding a full briefing from intelligence officials on what President Trump knew when about intelligence that says Russia is paying the Taliban money to kill U.S. troops.
House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer said he came away from a briefing this morning by White House officials with the impression that the president had not been briefed on such a serious matter, which Hoyer called very, very troubling.
The president called this a hoax. Publicly. Nothing in the briefing that we have just received led me to believe it is a hoax. There may be different judgments as to the level of credibility, but there was no assertion that the information we had was a hoax.
NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales joins us now. And Claudia, Steny Hoyer and other Democrats very concerned. What else are you hearing today?
They're raising concerns that the right briefers weren't in the room today. I'm told by Democratic aides they included White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, and Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe. And what members said is they wanted to hear from career intelligence officials. For example, CIA Director Gina Haspel, that's one official they really want to hear from, and others who would be familiar with these reports. And they also said they didn't learn anything they didn't know already. So this was a comment by Representative Elliot Engel of New York. He's the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And so they're concerned that they didn't get any new information today. In all, nearly a dozen members joined the majority leader, Steny Hoyer, to take in this briefing. And among them was Adam Schiff, chairman of the Intelligence Committee. He said he still has many questions and he remains highly concerned the administration hasn't done more already to respond to these reports. For example, he doesn't understand why President Trump hasn't taken to the American public and made clear, I'm aware of these reports. I'm going to get to the bottom of them.
Well, Republicans were briefed yesterday. Let's hear this from Texas Republican Michael McCaul, who described what he heard in the briefing yesterday to NPR.
There's a huge volume of intelligence that comes through. They obviously choose which to brief him on, and they want it to be credible when they brief him. And so at least that's what they told us, you know. And so, you know, did the president kind of wake up and say, gee, I wish I had known about that? I don't know.
Claudia, are Republicans as alarmed as Democrats, or do you just expect them to follow the president, who's essentially saying his hands are clean, he didn't get briefed?
I'm seeing a real split with Republicans. Some are that alarmed. Some are demanding additional details, but some are following the president's lead here. For example, some of these members, including McCaul, who attended this White House briefing yesterday, afterwards echoed the White House's narrative that the intelligence community is conflicted on what actually happened and that they didn't think that Trump needed to be briefed at that time. At the same time, they're calling for a response if the intelligence community can further prove out these allegations. For example, I spoke with Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois. He's a combat veteran, and he said as members get more answers, they'll know what the response needs to be. So we're hearing from plenty of Republicans who say the response needs to happen. Perhaps it needs to be swift in some cases, and they want to move on to this next stage depending on what details come out further. Some are already calling for sanctions, for example.
Right. So I was just going to ask you if you're referring to a response from the president or if you're referring to the United States response to Russia for, you know, allegedly putting this bounty on U.S. troops.
Yeah. So we're hearing a lot from Republicans in particular who are focusing on the response from the United States to Russia. For example, they are raising this idea of calling for sanctions. And Adam Schiff, as I mentioned earlier, he's calling for questions to be raised about whether Russia can join the G7, for example. Plans such as this that have been raised before by President Trump need to hit pause and they need to be reassessed in light of these new details. So we're seeing a variety of proposals from both Democrats and Republicans on what these next steps should be. But we imagine as we get more details, as they get more details, they'll have a better picture of what that might look like.
And I do want to ask you about another detail we're learning about today. The New York Times is reporting that, in fact, the intelligence was written in the president's daily briefing. This was back in late February. What's the White House saying about that?
So in terms of the White House, they are sticking to this line of defense, saying the president personally wasn't briefed. Despite these reports, perhaps this was in a briefing in 2019, as we're hearing. But the White House continues to stand by this defense and say the president personally was not briefed.
Well, it's all out there now, and so it'll be interesting to see what's next, what the response will be, as we've talked about, but also what kind of hearings we might encounter on Capitol Hill. Do you expect to get more out of this?
It seems that momentum is building towards some potential hearings, but that is going to take some agreement between Republicans and Democrats on what those may look like. We may see a better opportunity for that on the House side, where Democrats are leading the charge to take a closer look at this. And we'll see if Republicans, since they're split on this issue, whether they can come to an agreement on what they want to do when it comes to these hearings.
NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Griselas on a very important story. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
And a ruling from the Supreme Court today could impact how much public funding religious institutions can get. In a 5-4 decision, the court decided that it is unconstitutional for the state of Montana to exclude religious schools from a state scholarship program that's funded by tax credits. Tom Gelton covers religion and belief for NPR. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Robin.
And so tell us more about the decision and this Montana state scholarship program.
Right, Robin. Well, as you say, that Montana program was enacted in 2015, under which taxpayers could get dollar-for-dollar tax credits if they donated to a scholarship program for private schools. That means for every dollar they contribute to that program or contributed, that would reduce their tax liability by $1. So it was a kind of a voucher program. The problem was that there was a provision in the Montana state constitution barring state aid to religious schools. And when the Montana Supreme Court considered this, it ruled that the whole scholarship program violated that. What it did is it threw out the entire program for all private schools. Some parents who had wanted that scholarship money to send their kids to religious schools sued. The court today sided with the parents.
Yeah. And after Chief Justice Roberts sided with the court's liberal wing yesterday in that abortion decision today, he did side with the majority conservatives and wrote the opinion. What did he say?
Well, he based his argument largely on a previous Supreme Court case involving a Lutheran school in Missouri, Trinity Lutheran, that had been denied state funding to pave a playground at the school. That was funding that was available to other schools, but denied to Trinity because it was a religious school. In that case, the court found in favor of the religious schools, saying there was no reason it should not get funding for playground paving just because it was a religious school. But the opinion was really narrow. It seemed to apply only in that specific situation. What Roberts said today is that Trinity Lutheran opinion was actually much wider. He said that funding for schools generally, even to support religious education, let's say, cannot be denied to religious schools. So it's not just a matter of funding for playground, but funding for the religious program. He argued that religious schools in both cases were discriminated against simply because they were religious.
It's interesting. He seems to be looking back at a lot of other cases in his decisions. But what did the dissenting justices argue?
There were basically two dissenting opinions, both of which essentially said there was no reason this case should have even gone to the Supreme Court. Justice Ginsburg said that because the Montana Supreme Court had thrown out the entire program, it wasn't even in existence anymore, how can you argue that there is discrimination? The program doesn't even exist. Justice Breyer also said that the court shouldn't have really taken up this issue, although for a different reason. He pointed out the two parts of the freedom of religion provision in the Constitution, one saying that the state cannot establish a religion, the other saying that free exercise of religion cannot be prohibited. He pointed out that those two provisions can seem to be in conflict, and the court needs to be really careful in adjudicating these issues so as not to sort of favor one provision over the other. He basically said that it's important that government, quote, play in the joints, and so he would prefer that the court doesn't get into the nitty-gritty of these cases.
Well, the Associated Press saw this decision as narrowing the separation of church and state. Does this mean, in about the minute we have, that it's going to have implications outside of schools?
I think it could, Robin. You know, there are 38 states that have provisions like Montana's that bar government aid for religious schools. And because the Supreme Court in this case took on that Montana provision, I think it really does call into question all those other states that have similar amendments. So I think that we haven't seen the last of this by any means.
Well, and there are a couple other interesting religious cases we're waiting for from the court, one about the Affordable Care Act and access to free birth control, the other about religious schools and discrimination. We only have about a half a minute, but, you know, I'm sure you're looking forward to those as well.
Indeed. I mean, this is the one on birth control is yet another litigation involving the Affordable Care Act. The court has never been really happy with the way that has worked out. We'll see another ruling there. And then there's another one on the so-called ministerial exception, whether religious teachers can be protected by employment law.
Oh, we'll be waiting for those. With NPR's Tom Gelton, who covers religion and belief for NPR. Tom, thanks so much.
Anytime, Robin.
If you're a fan of country music, you'll recognize this voice. It's been a while, but Grammy-winning country star Clint Black has a new album. Out of Sane is his 23rd studio album and his first in 5 years. That's What I Knew Then, written along with his longtime collaborator Hayden Nicholas. Clint Black joins me now. Clint, welcome. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Good to talk to you. Thanks.
So here you are releasing your 23rd studio album in the middle of a pandemic. That's got to be kind of a different situation.
Yeah, well, everything started off normal enough, and it took a turn. And it's been weird, but not that weird for me, because when I come home off the road, I tend to stay home most of the time. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that weird for a while, and then it started to become weird.
Well, let's talk about some of the music, because, you know, we are in a moment in this country right now, and I think you know that. When I hear this track, it is called America, Still in Love with You.
We had a rocky start, never certain it would last. We nearly came apart, but now that's all in the past. We stood the test of time, and though it doesn't seem that long, we've towed the line for years now, and we're still going strong. You've gotta know you're not alone. I'm still in love.
Clint Black, tell me about this song, because you sound optimistic about this country at a time when, you know, frankly, many are despairing over the future of it.
Yeah, I am optimistic. I'm a history buff, so I know a bit about what America has been through. So when people say this is the worst it's ever been, I know that's not true. America's aspirations are great. Its future is always uncertain. We can't know what's going to happen next. But if history tells us anything, we will get through this and we will be more united than ever before.
There may be people who listen to this who also draw on history who say, you know what, this doesn't apply to me. In fact, America is not my friend, like you say in the song, that its deep structural problems through history have kept me down.
Well, I would just remind them that there are a lot of people who fought, some died, to see the change come about. And that should give them hope. I think if you look around for the tiles that didn't stick to the wall, then that's all you're going to know. But if you focus on the ones that stayed, it might give you hope.
I'm still in love with you, even when you lose your way. There's nothing I won't do to bring you better days. You're the best one that I've got, and I'm still in love.
we're going to talk more about your music in just a minute, but I just have to ask you this final question, because I know that you know Donald Trump. You were a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice back in 2009. I mean, what do you think? Has the president been good for this country?
You know, I don't really know him. It's kind of like doing the Tonight Show when you're on camera and the show is running. That's the interaction.
But he fired you. You know that for sure.
He did fire me. I was grateful, and I was headed home, and they begged me to come back for the finale as a returning cast member, and I regretted that instantly. It's such an abusive environment. As far as Donald Trump goes, as the president, I think if you hate him, you're not going to find anything good, and if you love him, maybe you're not going to find anything bad. You know, I just go with the idea that I have my vote. I'm very private about it. I tend to get upset about government spending, and I haven't seen anyone do a lot about that. And that should be a bipartisan issue. I don't know anyone who squanders their own wealth away with disregard, and we shouldn't stand by and watch our government do it.
Well, listen, thank you for talking politics with me. I know you're here to promote a new album, so let's hear some more of it. This is Everybody's Talking.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear a word they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind.
Now, people might remember this song from the 1960s by Fred Neil, featured in the film Midnight Cowboy. Isn't this pretty rare for you to cover something that's not yours? You know, of all the songs you could have picked, why this one?
I kind of was inspired to do that by James Taylor, who I noticed for at least a few albums he would include one cover song. And I think it speaks to my influences and hopefully an ability to breathe new life into something that we've all loved for years without ruining it in the process.
Yeah. You know, I love looking back with artists. And so I would you mind if we just, like, listen to something from the 80s and 90s? Because you were huge in the 90s, and I just want to hear a little bit of that, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Okay, this is Where Are You Now?
Maybe I took for granted you'd be around to pick me up on my way down. I thought my feet were planted firmly on the ground till one day my whole world came unwound.
You remember that one, Clint Black?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the rare songs I wrote on the road. My lead guitar player and I wrote it in the back of the bus. His mom was in trouble, health troubles, and she was the person he had relied on his whole life, and now that person wasn't there to help him get through this, sort through it. And that was his burning question, you know, where is that person who's going to help me figure this out?
I remember my dad, just not a very emotional guy at all, just belting the chorus of that song out every time it came on. I grew up listening to you in the 80s and 90s, and I always will remember that song.
That's a burning question on fire in my mind. You always had the answers for me time after time. So all I'm asking is where are.
What's your impression of the 90s? Was it a fun time, a hard time, or what?
It was all of that. It was a whirlwind. It was, you know, it was a time when I was working so hard that my chief concern was, am I going to be able to sing tonight? You know, I remember telling my manager, you know, I'm not Joe Cocker, and I don't want to sound like Joe Cocker. You know, we have to remember the kinds of songs I sing and the sounds and the high notes I have to hit, and we've got a safeguard. It didn't happen, so eventually I kind of fought back against that. And, yeah, I used to tell people, you know, what drives all of my decisions now is am I going to be able to hit the high note on Put Yourself in My Shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a fight, almost a desperate fight at times, to push back against the pressure to just keep talking.
And if I could only put myself in your shoes, I'd walk right back to me.
That was a good song. I love that song.
Thanks.
Yeah, listen, let's hear one more from the new album. Here's Find Myself.
Half my life's been suitcase packed. Some kind of gig bag on my back. Seems like one long endless tour.
I hear some of the high notes there a little bit.
Yeah, that's it. You don't roll out of bed and sing that one.
Look, I consulted this source called Wikipedia who tells me you're 58 years old.
Yeah.
How much longer are you going to be making albums? Do you think you have, like, Willie Nelson longevity in you?
Well, God only knows, right? You know, it's all about health, and I still have the desire. I look to people like Willie Nelson, like Eric Clapton, Paul McCartney, and they give me hope. If James Taylor, you know, can still be making some of his best music at his age, maybe I can too.
That's Clint Black, country music star. His new album is Out of Sane. Clint, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And me too, Peter. Thank you.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi says the country's coronavirus death rate is under control, but he also says India is at a critical juncture in the pandemic. Modi spoke to the nation on a day when India reported more than 18,000 new infections, bringing the country's total to more than 566,000. It's the fourth highest in the world. The BBC's Yogita LeMay joins us from Mumbai on Skype. And what else did the Prime Minister say today?
Well, yes, I mean, he did say that a timely lockdown and other decisions that the government has taken have saved hundreds of thousands in India. And, you know, while his claim of a lower death rate compared to other countries around the world, so around 17,000 people have died of the infection so far in India. And if you compare that to sort of countries which have a similar number of cases as India, you find that actually the number of people who've died of coronavirus in India is a lot lower. Mm. However, you know, I have to say that their questions are being consistently raised about how those COVID numbers are being counted. At the BBC, we've done reports speaking to frontline doctors in Mumbai, in the national capital in Delhi, in the western state of Gujarat as well, who've told us that actually, you know, sometimes people who are brought dead to the hospitals, they are not tested. So even if they're likely to have died of COVID because they have all the symptoms, they're not counted among the COVID dead. So I think, you know, while his claim and the official number certainly seems to be that, you know, not as many people compared to other parts of the world have died in India, I think there are serious questions being raised about whether this official number actually reflects the true scale of the coronavirus outbreak in India.
And in fact, maybe another sign that things aren't as rosy as he says. In Delhi, there is a new 10,000-bed hospital that opened over the weekend. It's been described as one of the biggest hospitals in the world.
So, yes, I mean, you know, over the past, I think, few weeks, what we've seen in Delhi, you know, what we saw about 2 or 3 weeks ago in Mumbai is people really struggling to get any kind of care. You know, in both these cities and other parts of the country as well, there are families who've actually lost loved ones going from hospital to hospital because, you know, either beds were full at the facility they went to, or, you know, some of the facilities were too worried about treating coronavirus patients. And it's to kind of rectify that, that these temporary hospitals are being built. So this facility in Delhi you're talking about, even in Mumbai, we've had temporary facilities that have been built in like sports arenas, you know, one in an open field even. And while those have definitely added, you know, what I'm hearing from the ground is that that's definitely helped in terms of sort of primary care for someone who perhaps needs oxygen. You know, at the same time, it's very hard to build critical care capacity because it's not just about equipment, a bed and a ventilator. It's also about having trained staff, doctors and nurses available. So there is still a shortage of that in the country.
Finally, I want to ask you about news that there is government approval for clinical trials of a potential vaccine. What can you tell us about that?
That's right. There is a vaccine that will be trialed from July onwards. It's going to be done by a firm called Bharat Biotech, which is based in the southern city of Hyderabad. What we know is that tests they've done on animals so far suggest that the vaccine is safe. And so they basically applied for permission to now test it on human beings. That permission has been granted.
All right. The world will keep an eye on that development. The BBC's Yogita LeMay in Mumbai. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Professional athletes have been speaking out for social justice. The Taking a Knee movement, inspired by Colin Kaepernick, comes to mind. But now, some athletes are also stepping aside, saying this is the moment to fight for social justice, not to play sports. Colorado Rockies outfielder Ian Desmond joins the list. The biracial player announced yesterday he will not play this season because the coronavirus makes it unsafe, because he wants to be with his family at this moment of pandemic and race reckoning, but also because of racial injustices within his sport. He writes, "We've got a minority issue from the top down. One African-American GM, two African-American managers, less than 8% black players, no black majority team owners, and perhaps most disheartening of all, the puzzling lack of focus on understanding how to change those numbers." So that's Ian Desmond leaving the baseball field. Then there's 11-year WNBA veteran Renee Montgomery, an Atlanta Dream standout, leaving the basketball court.
Three-pointer for Renee Montgomery.
She breaks the lid on the basket.
Renee Montgomery with her second three-pointer.
Last year, Renee Montgomery started in and played all 34 games in the Women's Pro League, scoring double digits in 13 of them. You might remember her also from her days with the UConn Huskies, where she led her team to a 39-zip season, no losses, a national championship. Well, she recently announced through an editorial in the Players' Tribune that when the WNBA comes back, I won't be there. Like fellow WNBA player Maya Moore, who left in January to focus on judicial justice, Renee Montgomery wants to fight systemic racism and social injustice. As she says in her editorial, all it takes is a single moment. Renee Montgomery joins us now by Skype from Atlanta. Renee, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
This is quite a thrill for many of us who did follow you, you know, all the way from Connecticut on up. But tell us about that moment. What was that moment? Was it seeing the video, seeing the marches?
Yeah, definitely. It was a combination. So I think that 8-minute and 46-second video shocked us all. It woke us all up. It made us all feel a certain way. If it didn't, something's wrong, because that was hard to watch. So that moment was the moment that started everything for me. Just realizing that things aren't going to fix themselves.
Yeah. This is a huge move for you. Some people might be saying, WNBA, it's not like the NBA. Or they might be saying, well, you know, who knows what's going to happen with sports anyway because of the pandemic. How big a decision was this for you?
Oh, it was huge. I've done it my whole entire life. It's been all I know. You know, starting it at 10, playing AAU at 12, it was what I did in school for fun, and then it became my job. So if you don't think going away from something you've done your whole life is a big decision, it is.
Talk about starting basketball when you were 10 years old. You've written you felt isolation. of being the only black kid in your class in elementary school. Where was that, by the way?
Yeah, in West Virginia. So I grew up in West Virginia. So no surprise there that I was the only black student in class a lot of times when I was younger. That's just the population. I mean, in my city, there's 3% black population. So there's just not a lot of black people there. So I did feel that. And, yeah. And you know, I didn't even think about it then. You know, like, it's like it was the norm. The same happened with my mom, my sister. So it was kind of like, well, this is what we do.
Yeah. Navigate, as you say, the white spaces.
Exactly. And honestly, that's why I'm so understanding of the other side of the different cultures, because I've been submerged in those cultures my whole life. So even going overseas, when I've started playing professional, we are submerged in other people's cultures. So once you see how someone lives and see how they think and they move, you start to understand that person more.
Tell us more about that. What kind of understanding do you think you bring to this moment, having had your feet in different worlds?
I understand that people can't understand what they don't know. And so growing up in school, Black History Month was 1 month. It was 1 month, and they talked about probably three people, you know, the Martin Luther King, the Malcolm X.
Rosa Parks.
You knew the bus boycott. Yeah, Rosa Parks, exactly. Those same heavy hitters. But if the history books went in chronological order, there's no just specific time where you only talk about Black history, I think that a lot of white students would understand the plight of Black students, of Black people, of Black culture. But they don't know. A lot of people don't know about the Tulsa Massacre. They don't. They don't know about Black Wall Street because they weren't taught it in school. I learned it outside of school. So I think that's where a lot of the disconnect is. If people knew what a lot of different cultures went through, I think they would be more understanding. I'm not sure when is the last time the history books have had some updates, because if you start young and teach history, all history, I think young kids will start to understand Black culture and start to understand where people talk about their Black pride, overcoming. People don't even understand why Black people feel like they've overcame a lot. They'll be like, oh, that happened 400 years ago. What did you overcome? And people don't realize that my mom was involved in walkouts. My mom was an activist. It's not that far removed. We just saw Bubba Wallace had a noose in his garage. Okay, it wasn't for him, but who tied the noose? We're not that far removed.
Well, you know, there are people, lots of people walking around who remember when it's okay for Blacks not to vote, or when lynchings were still
exactly.
common in my lifetime, you know, or books for children never had a face of color ever.
Yeah. So it's not the little kids' fault that don't know. We have to teach people. Education is how people begin to understand. So there has to be a teaching aspect younger that starts younger so that they can just understand that Black history is a part of American history.
So you're thinking of maybe speaking about this?
That's yeah. just one part of it. Yeah. And that's conversations again. And secondly, HBCUs.
HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities, which did get more funding through Congress earlier this year, but you say they need even more.
A lot of HBCUs don't have funding in the creative spaces. You know, they barely have enough funding for things that are necessities. So I think that's a good place to start.
And you say that a large part of this, something that moved you, just like compelled you, was a hard decision. But part of that was you're doing this for your nephews. Explain that.
Yeah. So my nephews, I have three nephews in particular that are 6'4", 6'3", and 6'5". And so one time, this is before the incident with the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, but one time one of their neighbors was following them around the neighborhood. They were riding their bikes. This is during quarantine. You know, they're young, they're kids. They want to be active. And there was a neighbor following them around. Nothing happened. But to me, that's alarming. You know, they see that that my nephews are big in stature, and they see them as a threat. And so for me, that's very nerve-wracking, knowing that right now, Black men are targets.
You know, I was thinking, too, that others might see them as, basketball players. And that's also, in a way, offensive, too. Because it denies you seeing them as future rocket scientists or whatever it might be.
Exactly. Once you start to categorize people as you judge them, and that's when we run into problems, because it's not your place to judge who they are. You know, like even if you're somebody's neighbor, and I know we've seen a lot of these videos, people have to understand that people have a right to certain spaces, public spaces. So things are alarming.
Yeah. Did you tell your coach or ask your coach?
None of the above. We were having a conversation about Maya Moore. So it was almost like I was talking to him about what he said to Maya Moore when she was trying to make her decision. He didn't know that I was thinking about making mine, But I was just using all that information that he was saying. I was just soaking it all up.
And Maya Moore, of course, another player who left. And what was he saying?
He was just, you know, talking about, am I prepared for what's going to happen when you do make the decision? So he was telling her, like, are you prepared financially? Are you prepared that people don't look at former athletes the same way they look at pro? Are you prepared to give up that title, to give up that status? You know, he was just asking different things to make sure she understood what she was giving up. And so as he was saying the things he was asking her, yeah, I'm okay with that. People don't revere me the same way. Like, I'm okay with that.
You are okay with that.
I'm okay with that.
For something bigger.
Exactly, because I feel like what I'm doing is that serious.
Do you ever dream at night about giving up the jump shot, you know, the physical thrill of it?
Yeah, like that's the thing. You know, athletes, it's muscle memory. Again, I told you I've been doing it since I was 10. So you better believe that I'm going to have times where I miss it. And I'm going to be watching a lot of sports, too. You know, they've already told me that they're going to include me in things. So I'm going to get my fix by watching my teammates.
Atlanta Dream player Renee Montgomery leaving the WNBA to focus on social action, racial injustice, a plan that's forming right now. Renee, we wish you the best with everything, and we hope maybe, you know, just like a sort of a halftime show-off thing you can come back and do. Or
something. I'm in. I'm down.
Renee, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Social media sites are bending under pressure to crack down on hateful content, and much of it happens to be political. Reddit has purged a popular pro-Trump forum called The Donald. The streaming site Twitch also temporarily banned a campaign account for President Trump, accusing it of hateful conduct. Meanwhile, more advertisers are joining a boycott, pushing Facebook to step up its policing of violent and inflammatory speech. Let's bring in Casey Newton, Silicon Valley editor at The Verge. Hi, Casey.
Hi there, Peter.
Hey, so let's start with Reddit. This was a big move that a lot of people had been calling for a while now. What was banned? Is this hate speech or is it political speech or all of the above?
It is not political speech, and it is supposed to be mostly hate speech. What happened is that Reddit, which had maybe the shortest list of rules of any of the big social platforms, basically did a full rewrite and introduced a new rule number one that said you have to acknowledge the humanity of everyone else on the service, and you're not allowed to treat them as less than you if they're different from you. And under that new rubric, they went in and banned about 2,000 communities, most of which were almost totally inactive or had very few members. Mm-hmm. But a couple of them, including The Donald, were some of the most notorious subreddits that had ever been created.
And what kind of content was on The Donald?
Well, it began as a place for supporters of the then candidate Donald Trump to gather, but it quickly attracted an extreme fringe right-wing audience that posted a lot of hate speech, racism, and incitements to violence. And so for Reddit, it has long been a subject that they were afraid to touch. And so a lot of folks were surprised yesterday when they finally removed it.
Yeah, this had been on Reddit's radar for a while. Why did they finally take the extra step of getting rid of it?
You know, it's a good question. I do think that this month's Black Lives Matter protests seem to have made a strong impression on them. I talked to the CEO, Steve Huffman, and he said that that had accelerated their timeline for crafting some new rules that created a Reddit that was a little bit closer in line to their values. I think that the old Reddit sort of believed in free speech above all else, but over time they came to see how enabling one kind of free speech, which is to say racism and incitement to violence, wound up driving away a lot of other speech that they would much rather host. And so he said that for him, it had sort of been an evolution of his thinking.
Now, another platform that we mentioned, Twitch, also temporarily took a Trump campaign account down after flagging it for hateful conduct. And again, you spoke with a representative of that company who said that Twitch does not make exceptions for political or newsworthy content. Talk about that, because this could be seen as a jab at Facebook, which has been under pressure to fact check political ads and do more about the hate speech on its platform.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting one because the video that Trump was broadcasting was his 2015 campaign kickoff rally, which was, of course, widely carried by lots of mainstream news networks. But this was the rally where he famously said Mexican immigrants are rapists,
right.
Which, you know, is extremely offensive, but was carried by a lot of the major news networks. And so it was somewhat surprising that just re-airing a broadcast that had originally aired in 2015 led Twitch to say, you know what, we don't want that on our site, get rid of it. So I would definitely say that that was among the more surprising of the temporary bans that came down yesterday.
Is that going to alienate conservatives or supporters of the president who say, look, this was in the public purview, this is a campaign rally?
Well, I mean, I think it's a fair question to say how much influence do you want to have these unaccountable networks to have over political speech, right? There are only so many of them. And if they say this kind of political speech isn't allowed, you know, maybe that just sort of chills speech overall. At the same time, I think most people do not want to be on social networks that are full of racist content, hate speech, and incitements to violence. And if you're building a business, I think it's sort of fair to say, hey, you know, get off our property with that sort of thing. If you want to talk like that, you know, amongst you and your friends, that's fine. But we're not going to provide you a platform and amplify that kind
right.
of speech.
Right. Go on the street corner if you want to say that.
Exactly.
Look, let's talk about Facebook for a second, because big iconic brands across the world are saying no more to Facebook. Unilever, Verizon, Starbucks, Coca-Cola, among the brands that have said they're going to pull ads from the site, saying they want Facebook to do more policing of its content. And look, there are critics who think these companies are either overstepping or maybe going a little too far. But you write in The Verge that the Facebook boycott advertisers have the right company here, but the wrong diagnosis. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think they're right to identify Facebook as an incredibly powerful force that probably needs some regulation. I just don't think that hate speech is necessarily the issue here. Facebook already bans hate speech, and it already removes a ton of hate speech. The issue is it's just so big that even if it fails to remove 1% of the hate speech that's on its servers, that means that there are still thousands and thousands of pieces of bad content up on the site. So I think if that's the problem that you want to solve on Facebook, you just have to start with how big it is and how it's kind of muscled out so much of its competition. And that's the thing that ultimately would shrink the problem.
That's Casey Newton, Valley editor at The Verge. Casey, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.